I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to take a closer look at what factors produce crime in Indianapolis. We're going to dive into the data in the Kids Count data book just released by the Indiana Youth Institute. We're going to talk about the damage done to young lives and the communities in which they live. My guests are Indianapolis Police Chief Troy Riggs and Andrew Cullen, Vice President of Public Policy for the United Way of Central Indiana. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about some new information from the Indiana Youth Institute's just released Kids Count data book and what the trends say about dangerous cultures that might lead to crime here in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are two veterans of the program, although one of them is wearing a slightly different jersey than he did the last time he came in. I am joined by Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Chief Troy Riggs in his first appearance in that capacity on the program, and Andrew Cullen, who is Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So first, let's give an overview on what we find in the Kids Count data book, the parts that at least are relevant to our discussion today. And I can throw that to either one. You want to start with it, Andrew?
Well, I'd be happy to. Thank you, John. Thanks for highlighting this issue. So the Kids Count data book, for your readers who might not be familiar with it, is a book produced yearly in a partnership with the Indiana Youth Institute with sponsorship from the Annie Casey Foundation and also the Lilly Endowment. That delves into statistics affecting kids in our communities, talking about how it affects our families, the economics of kids, health issues that children in our community are dealing with, the status of our education system, and also issues related to public safety.
And what do we find with this year's Kids Count data book? I mean, I know we have done programs before on the findings in the data book. And, you know, like last year, one of the big things was that that somewhere just between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 kids in the state lives in poverty, which I assume probably is still relevant this year. What else were the numbers that leapt out?
Mm-hmm.
I can throw that one also to Chief Riggs.
Well, some of the things that we look at as a police department, obviously going through the report, but some other things as well is that when you look at the Marion County Health Department and their recent survey, then you realize that our citizens, especially our young people, are 4 times more likely to suffer from depression mm-hmm. or a poor mental health day than anywhere else in the nation. That should be a concern to us. And then you realize that suicide is something that many of our young people think about almost on a daily basis. At least 14 days out of the last 30 days, I think, is what the survey said. Those are troubling statistics. And when you look in some of the neighborhoods that these young mm-hmm. people are living and residing and the struggles that they have, you're not really left to wonder why. We just need to figure out how to fix some of these issues. Think about a young person in today's world and looking at some of these statistics that will be shared in a moment. But for the most part, if you grow up in Indianapolis, you have tremendous opportunities. But there is a growing area in growing areas where young people are struggling day to day to get the basic necessities to live. When we met with 200 to 300 young people about a year and a half ago, they told us some things, John, that was alarming. One, they said they felt like no one loved them, no one cared about them, and that they were hungry when school wasn't in session. Is it any wonder they're dealing with some of the issues they're dealing with?
Is this, this is a persistent problem that I mean, at some level, we're dancing around the fact that we're talking about a what has been called a permanent underclass in this country. Persistent poverty, multi-generational poverty, and it has had the impact, obviously, you've in your previous capacity as public safety director, you were trying to attack the problem of crime holistically by attacking the roots that, that produce it. I'm assuming you're bringing that same approach to your current position.
We are. We want to look at these issues. We have the report. We're actually going to circulate the report to our command staff to get a better understanding. And sometimes people ask, why are you looking at reports like this when you're dealing with crime? And the answer is simple is, while we're focused on short-term crime prevention, we also have to be focused on long-term crime prevention. And what the report does, it gives us a picture of where we are as a city, where we are as Central Indiana, but it allows us to start crafting measures to deal with meeting some of these needs, which we believe if we deal with hunger, if we deal with mental illness, if we deal with dependency issues, and we deal with giving people opportunities, whether it's jobs during the summer for young people, that long term, that's going to enhance the quality of life, which in retrospect, looking past the years, when you enhance the quality of life, crime is lower. Very few of our homicides, very few of our major crimes occur in affluent areas where there's a high quality of life. Most of this occurs in small areas of our community where citizens are suffering. And let's remember, most of the citizens that live there, 99% of them are just trying to make ends meet. It's just a handful that's causing a lot of these issues.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the information released in the Indiana Youth Institute's Kids Count data book, which tracks sort of the progress of children and families in the state. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimitswfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So the numbers, two of the numbers that leap out, obviously, are the suicide number and the depression, right, that we talk about, mental health issues. And those are, if I understood you correctly, higher here than they are in other parts of the country.
Yes, and that's according to the report that Dr. Kane with the Marion County Health Department under her leadership put out recently. And that's another report that we have shared. It talks about all age groups, but we are certainly focused on those between 12 and 17 and 17 to 25 because we're seeing that is where growth of a lot of the youth violence and a lot of violence in general in our community is in.
Well, and generally violent crime is unfortunately a young person's game overall, right?
It is. And unfortunately in this city, which makes this report even more important, is that last year we had 14 suspects, 14 suspects in committing homicides in the city. That's out of about 94 suspects throughout the city, and 14 victims of homicides under the age of 18.
Okay.
That's a remarkable number. Those are all-time highs that we do not want to repeat in our city.
And in terms of the other numbers that that leap out, Andrew, I mean, what are the numbers that you see that provide sources of concern?
Yes, so the Coalition of Human Service Funders had a really great meeting with Mayor Hogsett a couple weeks ago where he discussed, as I'm sure the chief knows, his vision for public safety, which included prevention, enforcement, and reentry as the three key tools. And it was funny because he said, I'll take care of the enforcement. You guys work on the other two. And so when you think about prevention issues for criminal issues, we talk a lot at United Way about early childhood education.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, long-term longitudinal studies show that if a child shows up to school ready to learn, they are ultimately, over the course of their lifetime, 70% less likely to commit a violent crime. Why is that? It's very, very interesting as to why. What makes someone a criminal ultimately? Is it because they're poor? Is it because they're from a bad family? Is it because they're from a poor neighborhood? Is it because they didn't have solid parents? All those things are possible. They're definitely possible causes. But it's ultimately because they have a criminogenic need called antisocial cognition. In other words, they think they are outside of society. They're not part of society. This person believes that they have to take from society to survive in it. And when you first learn you're outside of society, it's when you show up for kindergarten. and the teacher says, you are not like the rest of these kids. We're going to put you in a special class. You're going to find yourself held back in the third grade. You're much more likely not to graduate with your class, and ultimately, you're 70% more likely then to turn to a life of crime. So, I mean, there was a great article today in the Star about the Indy Preschool Scholarship Program, which we administer at United Way. And the sad part about it was, even though we've had great success with an amazing amount of corporate support, we had to turn away 3,500 kids. Mm-hmm. 3,500 low-income families below 127% of poverty, most of which were in these high-crime areas, came to us and said, we would love to send our child to pre-K, but we cannot afford the average $6,800 a child cost, says the family that makes $24,000 a year.
Or less.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's one of our main focuses going forward, is to increase the availability of that type of education for our young people.
How much of this, I mean, because we're talking about sort of a netherworld here of, you know, at some level, political or governmental responsibility for this, and then philanthropic or corporate civic responsibility. How much of this is a product of the fact, I talked about the permanent underclass, the fact that in some ways we have been talking about these issues, not just here in Indianapolis, but in, you know, cities all across America now for the better part of a half century, if not more than a half century. And there is, I think, at least among a lot of rational observers, a feeling that, okay, most of the liberal solutions have failed. Most of the conservative solutions have failed. But we're still trapped in that same tired argument. How do we get beyond that and start looking at these numbers and finding an approach that works? I want to hear both of your thoughts on this, but Andrew, I'm going to start with you.
Well, that's a huge question.
I know
we can talk
is.
About that for a couple hours.
We have an hour. So
I'll just throw out one of the things that I like to talk about, which is the other side of the prevention issue that I just mentioned, which is the reentry issue. One of the things that came out in the Kids Count book was that 21.1% of Indiana high school students have a parent who has served time in jail and has a criminal history. This is a huge barrier to these people going forward and having a second chance in life. So one of the things we need to do a better job of is focusing on reentry here in Marion County. We are trying through the Marion County Reentry Coalition, which is a great group that comes together and has multiple work groups that work on this. We have to get more of our citizens to take advantage of the Indiana's expungement law, which is a fantastic new law that has recently taken effect. I mean, we ultimately also have to recognize that the war on drugs has not been as successful as we would like. I'm not going to declare that it has failed, but we have been incarcerating so many low-level drug offenders and creating havoc in their lives forever. And we have to really reconsider that, I think, on some levels and get them into treatment. The General Assembly has made some great strides on that lately, but we can't go backwards on that issue.
Chief Riggs.
I think when you look at the approach that Mayor Hogsett and I are trying to take, it's pretty unique. And that's one of the reasons that, once again, we've been invited to the White House to share, because they're seeing that we are moving an area that other cities have not. And we have this great collaborative spirit in this city with all the social service partners, the faith-based organizations. And what we believe is that when we put these issues out there and people can really see what's happening, whether it's through the police department or United Way or CICF or IUPUI, any of these host of agencies, when we meet monthly as a police department and as a city to deal with issues, as we recently did with some of the hunger issues we're facing in many of our cities, we have to get out of this norm of, as you said, the liberal side has failed, the conservative side has failed. The reason those have failed is not because of good ideas and good intentions. It's because we're still working in silos. We have to work together as a united community to deal with these issues. That's the only way we're going to see movement. So that's why we're excited that this summer, Gleaners has recommitted to go in and feed at least 60,000 people, 350,000 meals, because the kids told us they were hungry. This year, instead of just the feeding, which is extremely important, Gleaners is allowing other partners to come in and start dealing with wraparound services for mental health, dependency issues, EMS being on standby to help people. Let them understand the Affordable Health Care Act. We're all working together in unison instead of trying to do our small individual work. We're going to have to work together. These problems are generational. they've been developing over the last few decades. They're not going to be solved overnight. But if there's a city in America that can get this done, Mayor Hogsett and I believe it's this city because of the history of collaboration. And we're seeing that right now as groups are coming together. And people say, how does that affect crime? When we do that, crime tips in those areas where Gleaners is serving go up dramatically to record numbers because people feel like they're being valued and they're trying to take back their streets.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the new information from the Indiana Youth Institute's Kids Count data book and what it says about the cultures here that help lead to crime. My guests are Indianapolis Police Chief Troy Riggs and Andrew Cullen, who's the Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the information in the new Indiana Youth Institute's Kids Count data book, what it says about the trends and forces that might be helping to lead young people to crime in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Chief Troy Riggs and Andrew Cullen, Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana. Now, I have not scoured this latest edition of the Kids Count data book, but I saw, obviously, I looked at last year's and I mentioned that the number that leapt out is the number of children who live in poverty in this state. And when we're talking about other sources, and I know this has been a focus for Mayor Hogsett, too,
yes,
is dealing with the poverty issues. We also see statewide, and Indiana's not the only state where this is occurring, obviously, nationally, that there is tremendous pressure on sort of that lower half of the middle class, that the bottom is falling out. Can we talk a little bit about what those numbers indicate and the kinds of problems that they present, you know, in terms of dealing with crime or basically just helping people lead productive lives? We'll start with a crime piece first. I'll start with you, Chief Riggs, and then how we encourage them to lead productive lives, I'll throw to Andrew.
Right. Well, when you look at individuals that have no hope and they've been raised in an area where they're struggling, sometimes that does lead to crime, and we have to be realistic about that. So I go back to the story of when we met with these young people and said they felt like no one loved them, cared about them. They were hungry. The other thing we found out after subsequent conversations is that during the summer they really had nothing to do, and they had no money to go out and get involved in the community. And so we found about all these great individuals that are doing summer jobs. And when we spoke to these faith-based organizations, they said they were still lacking some money. So there's a public safety foundation here in the city of Indianapolis, and that foundation stepped up and raised like $51,000, $52,000 to provide summer jobs for young people. Now, once again, you're probably sitting there listening going, that's great, but what's that do to crime? Well, I'll tell you what happened was when they worked with a local church, Fervent Prayer, gave Pastor Jackson some additional resources. He was able to hire additional individuals. The kids had a little money in their pocket. They were able to go to a movie. They were able to buy some type of treat. They were being mentored. They were being cared for, loved while they were there. And the crime rates for those petty crimes that you usually associate with juvenile involvement went to zero. Not down 10%, not down 5%, went to zero. That's the impact that type of programming has for the safety of the city.
Andrew.
Well, I think we just have to recognize some of the facts that exist, which is you mentioned the childhood poverty rate. Mm-hmm. It's horrendous. It's particularly bad here in Marion County. Almost one-third of our children are living in poverty. And if you're from a black family, you have about a 44% chance of being a child who grows up in poverty. So we absolutely have to recognize that part of the solution here is to deal with income issues for our citizens. And so, you know, United Way invests in the Centers for Working Families, which is a model supported by the Annie Casey Foundation as well, that many of our community centers offer, which is a place that low-income folks can go in order to receive wraparound services, employment coaching, the ability to receive multiple resources that can help them focus on increasing their income, because we simply know that government is not there to provide the kind of supports that it used to be. One of the statistics that jumped out at me is the TANF numbers, which is the Temporary Aid to Needy Families. A lot of citizens, including citizens that have very good intentions, still believe that we sort of have families living on quote-unquote welfare, like we used to have before the Welfare Reform Acts. It's really interesting to note that in 2003, we had 52,000 families who received these monthly cash assistance checks. That's dropped to 10,000 families in 2014. In order to receive this monthly cash assistance check, you have to work full-time or be seeking employment full-time. And the average check for a family of four is $288 a month. So clearly, welfare as we know it no longer exists. So it's up to a lot of other groups, such as United Way and the Centers for Working Families and the social service network of this city, to find ways to help people lift themselves out of poverty through income supports. And we just absolutely cannot forget how critical that is.
If you are just joining us, we are talking really about the connections of social forces and crime or other poor life choices that young people might make. The springboard for the conversation is the release of the Indiana Youth Institute's Kids Count Data Book. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Leanne has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Leanne, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I just had a question. One of your panel commented earlier about how we had to turn away, or you guys had to turn away low-income families, quite a few. I can't remember the exact number you said, for pre-K early education, and gave some pretty impressive statistics on how that can shape the future for these children. And I was just thinking that no one really commented on, didn't we turn down in the state of Indiana federal money that would have helped our state be able to offer pre-K education to low-income families?
Yes, I'm going to throw that one to Andrew. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Leanne.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I believe you're referring to a grant opportunity that was available, I think, last year from the Department of Education. I think it's a bit of a stretch to say we turned down money. The administration decided not to apply for that grant. However, I cannot stress enough how grateful we are to the state's administration and the General Assembly for the support of pre-K that they've given so far. We're currently in the third year of a pilot program that's investing $10 million a year, and we are bringing additional funds to that through the city of Indianapolis and philanthropic sources. And we're coming together to try to figure out how to create the best program for us here in Indiana. And so we believe we have a lot of opportunity to continue to work with everyone at the State House to move forward on that in a positive way.
Is that, was a flash button issue. You remember there was a lot of criticism, and by administration, I should make it clear, since we've been talking about the HUDnet administration, or the Hogsett, shows how old I am, the Hogsett administration here in Indianapolis. We're really talking about the Pence administration at the state level. Governor Pence made that decision. But really, the programs that we've got now for pre-K are relatively small and pretty tightly focused. And what we're talking about is a much broader-based problem. Is that not the case, Chief Riggs?
It is. And you have to look at all of this collectively, and we have to work with the school districts. And, you know, money's tight. Mm-hmm. Money's tight nationally, and we're going to have to show that this works. I think this report is a step in the right direction. But when I talk about children hurting and we talk about these numbers, I don't think we really understand what some of these young people are going through and what they're facing in life in this great country of so many opportunities where they feel excluded. And when you spend time in these areas, you spend time with our social service partners and getting to meet some of the people in the in these areas of our community that are suffering, you see the despair. It's real. The numbers never really tell the true story. And I would suggest to any listener that is concerned about young people, concerned about the status of some of our individuals and how they live and their quality of life, get involved with one of these organizations. Go volunteer. Just drop by to see what they do. Go to United Way. Go to CICF. Go to Gleaners when they're doing this and start meeting some of the residents. What you'll find out is that there's a stereotype that people have of individuals that are in need and taking welfare. And what you'll learn is that most of the individuals you come in contact with are just struggling to make ends meet, trying to provide for the family the best way they can, and just everything stacked against them at this time. And when you talk to a young person that tells you that they feel like no one loves you or no one loves them and that they don't have a future, that kind of hits home with me, living in a country that I've always been told you can be anything you want to be. And they don't understand that. And quite frankly, I'm not sure I would have been successful if I grew up in that same environment either.
Well, and I guess, is there evidence in here or in your experience, Chief Riggs, in dealing with these communities? And I'm going to step back. I used to, many years ago, volunteer at an inner-city elementary school. And, you know, in some ways, both of you have alluded to this using slightly different terminology. This sense that these students live, or young people seem to feel like they are excluded from the American experience, that they are not included in this. The term I would use at that time was, it was almost like there was a breaking of the social contract, this feeling that, you know, that in its most basic terms, we all sort of operate by this set of rules that if you work hard and you do all of these things, there will be a place for you in some fashion. At the school that I volunteered at, you know, the assisted lunch and breakfast program was at 98%. We're talking about significantly high poverty levels. And you could tell that those young kids who came in when they were kindergartners were still somewhat fresh-faced and optimistic, but I always thought, particularly with the young men, by the time they hit the fifth grade, they'd begun to figure it out and figure out, oh, no matter how hard I work, there may not be a place for me here. Do we see exactly when that break point is or what the factors are that lead them to believe that they are outside the American experience?
Well, I can tell you, talking to single mothers in the community, and we talk to them as well, and they said that they feel like they do a pretty good job with their child until they get to reach that teenage years, and then they lose them to the streets because they're out trying to work. Mm-hmm. They're out trying to make a living, and while they're there, there's no accountability. And that's where we have to have a tough conversation in our community about dads being dads, mm-hmm. being involved. We have to have a conversation about what we're doing. But let me put it in a different way, John, and kind of share mm-hmm. my own experience that I don't do that often, but I think it's important for this, is that I grew up in a poor area of town, lived in a 900-square-foot home, but I had some things going for me that some of the young people we have in our city not. I grew up with a mom and dad. I grew up with a strong faith base, our church. I grew up where I was getting a decent education, not a great education, but a decent education, had some great teachers mm-hmm. and helped me along the way. And I always knew I had the ability, and I lived in a nation that afforded me the opportunities. And I really believe what the Declaration of Independence, one of the most important documents ever written, says: the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. I believed that I could obtain anything. I was told that growing up. But let's look just around the corner from our studios here. If you're familiar with Meridian and where Shortridge High School is, across the street is the Indiana Blood Center. Behind that is an area that we call the 34th and Illinois intersection area. And if you're a young person and you grow up there, think about this. You're walking home from school, a school that's not doing very well. You're walking home from school. You're passing, every fourth home you pass is vacant. There's illegal activity goes on there. There's 1,000% greater likelihood there's going to be a shooting in this area than anywhere else in the city of Indianapolis. and mental health issues are 600% greater than they are anywhere else. And you're probably being raised by a single mom that's probably 16, 17 years older than yourself. You have very little family structure, and they're just surviving. They don't know that there's opportunities in the United States to succeed. They don't know how to obtain that. That's a much different upbringing than what I had. What we're trying to do is not give people everything, but give them opportunities to succeed. And it's worked well for our country. What we have failed to do, in my opinion, and what we're trying to change now, is give these individuals that opportunity. They don't believe they have that opportunity now.
We've gotten a question from a listener via Twitter, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Joe asks, any stats or info on issues with indie youth due to food deserts or lack of basic nutritional education? Andrew, I'll throw that one your way.
Well, there are certainly a lot of statistics on those. We know we have a serious problem here in Indianapolis with food deserts. And that's why, you know, we're very gratified that Mayor Hogsett has indicated that that's a priority of his administration, and he plans to make that something that's managed out of his office directly. Really, basically, what we know is that we also have a problem with not enough individuals signing up for SNAP benefits, which is a supplemental nutrition assistance program. We know that families are much less likely to be food insecure if they take advantage of those opportunities. And so we encourage anyone who believes that they might meet that income threshold, which is not nearly as low as other income thresholds, to call 211. Just dial 211 right now from your phone. Go online. They will do an immediate screening, and they will tell you how to get signed up for SNAP benefits. Because we know that in the Kids Count book, for instance, one in six Hoosier households struggled to afford enough food in 2014. If you don't have enough food to eat, you're fundamentally not going to be successful at much else. And so instead of necessarily making a food bank or offering food assistance the first opportunity, we need to make sure that our citizens are signed up for the benefits that they're entitled to. And so, again, 211 is the place to find that out.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about kids and their needs as they confront difficult lives and in areas that often are afflicted by crime. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. James, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Are you all familiar with the term dog whistle politics?
We're seeing shaking heads here. So,
dog whistle politics is speaking about race in coded language, and I'm hearing dog whistle politics on this program, and that is you're dealing with an issue that is highly racialized, where institutionalized racism is a very big factor in terms of who ends up being incarcerated, who ends up in poverty, and so forth. But yet the issue gets avoided, or it gets expressed in terms like poverty levels, low-income families, et cetera, et cetera. And you're living in a state that where 35% of the prison population is black, but only 9% of the general population is black. There's a lot of institutionalized racism affecting the children who are the objects of this study, and I think it's really important that you as decision makers, policy makers, and so forth develop the capacity to talk about these concepts. I'm unfortunately driving, so I'm going to have to listen on the radio, but I hope you will address that issue because I think it's really very central to the discussion you're trying to have.
Well, thank you very much for the call and the questions, James. And yes, we will talk about the issue of race and how it plays into all of these challenges. And we will do that, I think, after we come back from the break. We are talking here on No Limits really about questions of the challenges that young people are facing that are detailed in the Indiana Youth Institute's just released Kids Count data book. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimitswfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Police Chief Troy Riggs and Andrew Cullen of the United Way of Central Indiana. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about race. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about poverty and other challenges that young people lead that might create dangerous cultures that could lead to crime in some parts of our community. My guests are Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Chief Troy Riggs and Andrew Cullen, who is Vice President of Public Policy for the United Way of Central Indiana. Just before we went to the break, a caller named James posed the question of the fact that we're not talking about race here, that, and he cited the fact that, you know, African Americans are 9% of the state's population, but they account for 35% of the prison population, and that they also have disproportionate representation in the poverty numbers and many of the other numbers. So we should talk about that. You know, what role does race play in addressing these problems? Chief Riggs.
Well, one of the things that we have focused on is, and when we use data and use that, we don't talk about race because it doesn't matter to us. We're talking about individuals that are harmed, people that are hurting, their fellow Hoosiers, fellow Americans. We need to do better. Doesn't matter to me as police chief if they're white, Hispanic, if they're African American. It does not matter. It should not matter to us. And that's one of the reasons we talk about human beings and the suffering that people are going through. In regards to the numbers, we have to be careful using numbers. Most arrests and most people in prison come from urban areas. Those are much more diverse than the rest of Indiana, so it's hard to draw direct comparisons. However, if we want to have a conversation about race as far as the judicial system, I am certainly ready to do that and have been a proponent and one of the first, there was a group of us, first leadership of law enforcement in the United States to come together and challenge some of the state laws and regulations on some of the lower type crimes and offenses where people of color are being incarcerated greater numbers simply because they don't have the representation that somebody with additional monetary means would have, that they're being incarcerated and their children are suffering as a result, and families are breaking down as a result. We've had that conversation, and that is something we're very concerned about. But in some of our toughest areas of our community, the caller has an assumption that we're talking about all African Americans, and I can tell you when we've looked at the demographics, it's not all African Americans. It's a pretty diverse group. People are suffering. But we are concerned about the judicial system. We're trying to do something not just here in Indiana, but throughout the United States. But the reason we don't talk about race when we're talking about young people that are hurting as far as the police department and how we respond is that we're sworn to uphold the law for every citizen in this city. We want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help people have the ability to improve their quality of life, and that's regardless of the race in general. And anytime we bring up race and break that down, we have people criticizing us saying that we're targeting certain individuals. We're not targeting anybody. We're trying to help people. The last thing we want to do right now as a department is to arrest people. If we can find a way around arrest, we will do that. If we can find a way to get people on low-level charges out of prison, back in the streets, and be productive, we'll do that. You will hear me talk about aggressive policing for violent offenders, but you'll hear me talk equally passionate about reentry. So we need to, as a country and as a community, really wrap around our arms around both of those and make sure that we're working for the betterment of individuals. But the caller is right. There are some issues with the criminal justice system. There's a debate whether it's because of race or socioeconomic or a little bit of both. That debate will continue, and I promise you and give the word to my caller and to you and the citizens that we will be a part of that conversation here in Indianapolis.
Andrew, how much of this, I'm going to expand on James' question, though. How much of this, it's not like the world started, 5 minutes ago, and that we're all kind of dealing with what is a long history and a long-lasting legacy of institutionalized racial bias in this country. It's not specific to Indiana, although Indiana also is not exempt from that pattern. How much when we look at these numbers and all of that, how much is race at least part of the engine, or at least the fuel that drives some of these really desperate impacts?
Well, I agree with what the chief said about the philosophy of all of this and the way we should all be looking at this issue. But you're certainly correct, John. I mean, I think it would be unfair not to just admit that there is institutional racism that comes from places of our country's history that we should not ignore or pretend doesn't happen. The question is, how do we address it going forward? What do we do? What policy changes can we make to have a positive impact? And I think that we are going in the right direction generally there. We certainly know that the incarceration rate of black males is disproportionately unfair and unreasonable. And when you take a parent away from a family, naturally, there's going to be less parental structure, less ability for income to be generated, and ultimately a much higher likelihood that that child is going to become one in three children living in poverty. We can't deny that. And as long as we continue to, incarcerate folks for, you know, nonviolent low-level drug offenses instead of getting them treatment, we will continue to see that problem exacerbated. The good news is, and this is good news, that trend is reversing. We are going the different direction there. The General Assembly made a massive change to the criminal code 2 years ago that is just now becoming effectual, where we basically said, we're going to take violent criminals and we're going to incarcerate them for longer periods of time. The people we're afraid of, we're going to put behind bars, not just the people we're mad at. The people we're mad at, we're going to try to get them appropriate treatment so that they can be rehabilitated and rejoin society. And so it's important to note that we are making major policy changes to do what's called justice reinvestment, where you take the money that you were going to spend by throwing someone behind bars and locking up, you know, and throwing away the key, and instead reinvesting that money into something that makes them a better member of society. And there's no question that African Americans have been disproportionately harmed by that former system, and we've got to continue to improve upon it.
We are talking about young people, poverty, crime, and really how we deal with the difficult world. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Jim, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
You mentioned a few minutes ago about that more people should be taking advantage of expungement in order to get their felonies off their record. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to let people know that there are currently clinics on Sunday afternoon at Broadway United Methodist Church from 1 to 4 in which lawyers are doing pro bono work one-on-one with people to give them an opportunity to file for expungement and to understand exactly what they need to do, because you have one chance and one chance only. The only thing a person needs to do to be invited to one of these clinics is to register, and I'm going to suggest that they go to the website journeybeyondredemption.org. That's a group for women who are reentering society. There is also one for men, and there's a connection to that on that website. These clinics can be tremendously helpful. We're concerned with the generationalness of this as it goes on. So many people recidivate and go back to prison that in many families it becomes standard to think that that's what happens to adults. We've had mentors working with people who said, you mean I don't have to go to prison? That doesn't have to be part of my life? We need to break those images down. And one of the ways to prevent recidivism is to get these felonies off people's records so it's easier for them to get jobs.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing that. And the URL again is Journey Beyond Redemption?
JourneyBeyondRedemption.org.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that piece of information. Yes,
I would just also add that if any of your callers are interested in learning more about an expungement, we have 3 not-for-profits that are United Way supported partner agencies that do these on a rolling basis. You can stop by the Indiana Legal Aid Society, the Indianapolis Legal Aid Society, Indiana Legal Services, I should say, the Indianapolis Legal Aid Society, or the Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic, all of which will provide expungements for eligible citizens at no cost to them.
We are talking about the Indiana Youth Institute's newly released Kids Count data book for this year. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Mary Ann, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is this. Is Kids Count or any of CICF or United Way collecting any data on the number of times children in Indianapolis, especially the middle parts of Indianapolis, change schools during their, you know, elementary and high school education? It seems, you know, just as I look at the children who connect with our own family's life, who are at various economic levels, it seems like children go to a lot more different schools during the years than I've ever was used to myself, and also a lot more different schools during their education than I see our friends going to as I look out, you know, towards Greenwood or Plainfield or Zionsville, those areas. And if you're collecting the data, do you see a connection between multiple changes in schools and reduced outcomes?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mary Ann.
You're welcome.
Andrew, I'll throw that one your way, since I saw you thumbing through the book here
and
looking
way,
for the relevant numbers.
If you haven't taken a look at this Kids Count data book, I encourage you to do so. It's available on the Indiana Youth Institute's website at www.iyi.org. It's just an amazing resource for information. But, you know, one of the issues that is discussed is attendance and engagement, because we certainly know that students who are engaged and attend are much more likely to be successful. And we know that low-income students who families are forced to move, most likely and usually based on a job transfer or a job change, are not able to complete their education in the same school. And in terms of statistics on those, it is something that we are able to track. Each student receives a student testing number when they enter kindergarten, and that number is able to track their enrollment through school to school. So it is a number that the Department of Education would have the ability to track, and it's something that we keep an eye on, and it's a very, very good point. It's something that we need to keep in mind.
Is that the, you know, the larger question there is one of transience, you know, not having a stable home or a stable home life. Is there data that indicates that, and what are some of the impacts on young people if that is the case? Chief Riggs.
Don't have the data, but I can tell you that just speaking with people in the community meeting, speaking with Dr. Farabee, you know, a lot of times young people will get in trouble at school. Mm-hmm. They'll end up going to another school, and then they'll get in trouble there. It's something going on in the home life that's causing them to act up in school. The other thing that we're finding out, and I can't say enough about Dr. Farabee, but now we're finding out kids are coming to school and underperforming or acting up, and come to find out they've witnessed a crime. Mm-hmm. They've seen someone in their family assaulted. How do you deal with that in the mental illness issue? Sometimes people move there, but there are stories like that throughout all school districts. And I remember a lady that was having her mail delivered to a post office box. And she finally had to give an address so they could prove that she lived in a certain school district. But she wanted to go, her kids to go to a school district that she thought they could succeed in. And they were homeless, and they actually lived in a parking lot. And she made that her home because she wanted to give her kids an opportunity. These are the issues that we're facing. I wish we had better numbers. Mm-hmm. We don't. But what this report has given us and what Dr. Farabee's doing, what Joe Hogsett is doing as mayor, I think over the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to see a lot more numbers. And every time I'm on your show, mm-hmm. I get another idea of something else to dig in data. The good news is now this city has a data center through the city of Indianapolis under the mayor's leadership that is now looking at these issues, working with IUPUI and other researchers. So I'm going to add a couple of those to our list. I think that's going to be important to look at.
Let me ask this, because part of what we see is, you know, the indicators that you have much better chance of success in life if, you know, you live in a home, you grow up in a home with some economic stability, with a couple of parents who love and care about each other, and you go to decent schools, and, you know, you have all sorts of reassurance that things could be okay for you. What do we do, though, and that seems to me the central question, when those things don't exist for a young person? What seems to work when those essential building blocks aren't there? Chief Riggs.
Well, I will say this. When I was in D.C. at the White House for my brother's keeper's announcement by the President of the United States, he said something I thought was very profound. I'm not going to get it exactly right, but he said that he was talking about this very thing, and he was talking about young people and the young people not having opportunities because maybe they don't have a father, the father left or the mother left, or there's some other structure. And he said, when that occurs, it's incumbent upon the rest of the adults in the community to wrap their arms around these young people and meet their needs. And I thought that was something that would resonate well here in Indianapolis. When we see these issues, we need to wrap our arms around and try to help. Now, there are cities that have done some programming that has helped, but I got to be honest with you, the reason we have so many issues here in Indianapolis and we have so many issues in other cities is we have failed as a community to meet these needs. So there's no one city to look at and say, that's the way to do it. We're going to have to work together to figure out that formula, so to speak, of what works here to help these young people have hope.
Andrew.
So interestingly, though, we have actually seen a significant increase in graduation rates at our high schools. And when you dig into the data and look at which schools are seeing the largest percentage of graduation rates, you're seeing that schools that have engaged in wraparound services in the school themselves have been the most successful. Here at IPS, we had a system for many years that was funded by United Way of Central Indiana called Bridges to Success. And now IPS is, in addition to continuing to partner on that program, expanding it and putting parent engagement educators in just about every neat school where the need is there. And effectively what that person does is when, you know, little Johnny is falling behind in class, instead of the teacher being fully responsible for finding an educational way to fix it, the parent involvement educator can find if there's some sort of a human service need. In other words, all the things that the chief has been talking about today that children experience in their communities, and whether there is some sort of synergy there with a community-based agency to help that child or that family address that problem so that they can return to school ready to learn and graduate on time.
I think that probably will have to be the last word, but I'd like to thank both of you. Always a provocative conversation when you guys come in. I'm grateful for it. I'd like to thank my guests, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Chief Troy Riggs and Andrew Cullen, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for United Way of Central Indiana. Thanks, guys, for coming
in. Thanks for having us.
Really
my pleasure.
Appreciate it. And I also would like to thank our audience, as usual, for some great questions and for listening. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.